from these wave functions, the spacetimes are singular. The next year, Karel Kukas, again through a series of canonical transformation, now using the traditional metric variables, again isolated the single degree of freedom, and he has results similar to those of Kastrup and Thiemann's. He has a wave function of the mass. The mass doesn't evolve, and if you reconstruct the metric is singular. More recently, in collaboration with Miguel Campiglia, using the sort of more modern Ashtiger variables, we were able to gauge fix the diffeomorphism constraint, so we got rid of it, and we were left with a Hamiltonian constraint that we noticed that one could rescale it to make it abelian. So we had only one constraint now, the Hamiltonian constraint, but moreover, it was abelian with itself, therefore it satisfied the Lie algebra. The quantization that one ends up getting, again, is equivalent to the one they had here. Everything boils down to a function of the mass, and in no sense is the singularity resolved. On the other hand, several authors, starting with Leonardo Modesto, but many others, including us, studied the quantization of the interior of a black hole using the fact that, classically at least, the interior of a Schwarzschild black hole is isometric to a Kantowski-Sachs cosmology. They could then just use usual loop quantum cosmology techniques and treat the Kantowski-Sachs geometry, and as usual, loop quantum cosmology resolves the singularity. So the singularity in these treatments, although it has the peculiarity of treating the interior as a cosmology, resolves the singularity. And finally, more recently, with Gambini, we studied the semi-classical theory now, just the sort of polymerized semi-classical equations, and we were able to find a solution for the complete spacetime with interior and the exterior of a black hole, sort of the analog of the Kruskal spacetime for the semi-classical theory. So this is a classical metric that solves these corrected equations, which are not the Einstein equations. They're the ones with the sort of quantum corrections. And we find in sort of consonance with this that the singularity is replaced by a region of high curvature that sort of tunnels into another region of spacetime. What I'd like to mention today is that actually this finding that we had here, that you could rescale the Hamiltonian constraint to make it abelian, doesn't depend on having gauge fix the diffeomorphism constraint. So accidentally, we did this first and then noticed this, but then we realized that you really didn't need to gauge fix the diffeomorphism constraint. You can leave the diffeomorphism constraint and you could rescale the Hamiltonian constraint to end up with an algebra of this sort. Diffeo with Diffeo is Diffeo, Diffeo with Hamilton is Hamilton, Hamilton with Hamilton is zero. Because this is a Lie algebra, you can carry out the Dirac quantization, for instance, using loop quantum gravity techniques. And actually, the remarkable thing is that the quantization can be completed in exact form. We can find in closed form the space of physical states that are annihilated by all the constraints. On this space of physical states that are annihilated by all the constraints, the metric operator can be represented as an operator corresponding to an evolving constant of the motion, and one can show that the singularity is resolved. And I'll tell you in a second what I mean by this, representing it as an evolving constant of the motion. So we use the sort of framework that was set up by Martin Boyewald and Swiderski some time ago for treating spherical symmetry with the Ashtiger variables. Here's the relation between the variable. So we have two canonical pairs, one along the radial direction that we call AX, EX and KX, and one in the transverse direction, E phi and K phi. And this is the relation to the usual metric variables, if you're interested in. The total Hamiltonian for the theory has this form. This is the shift and the diffeomorphism constraint, the lapse and the Hamiltonian constraint. And this is the rescaling and sort of recombination of the constraints that we are proposing. And in terms of this, one ends up with a constraint that is abelian. If you want to see that this constraint is abelian quickly, you can see it by the fact that there is this derivative there on the lapse that you could have integrated by parts and put it here. Meaning, for this to be abelian with the derivative there, this has to be the abelian with itself. And the only thing that could cause problems with the abelianity is this E prime. Remember, if you don't have primes, things commute with itself automatically. So EX prime could cause problems, but there's no KX here. As a consequence of that, this is abelian. So we can now proceed to follow what Boyewald and Swiderski had set up and proceed to do a loop quantization of this. So we set up suitable one-dimensional spin networks. So your spin networks now, there's only one radial direction. So your graphs for your spin network are a series of links. In your vertices, you have insertions corresponding to the transverse variable. So the radial variable behaves like a one connection, so you can build a regular holonomy along those links. The transverse variable behaves as a scalar, so you represent it as a point holonomy inserted at the vertices. And you have the valences here for the sort of radial connection, and you have the valences for the insertion of the transverse variable. And this graph in sort of formulas, this is what it is. So this is a regular sort of line holonomy for U1, and this is just a point holonomy for the variable K phi. On these type of spin networks, the triads, or more precisely, the fluxes of the triads are well-defined. So if I were to integrate this along a small surface, these Dirac deltas would go away, and these quantities would be finite, just like in sort of the full theory. And to promote this constraint to an operator, to put a hat on top of it, as is usually the case, we have no problem with sort of EXs, but one has a problem putting a hat on top of K phi, because this is like a connection, and it's not well-defined, and similarly for Kx. And so one has to polymerize it. So one replaces, for instance, K phi squared by sine over parameter times K phi divided by the parameter squared. And this quantity that we have here, there's no problem putting a hat on top of it. Everything is well-defined, and it can be quantized. The action of the Hamiltonian constraint on a spin network state is given here. And so it's finite and well-defined. And more surprisingly is that by sort of positing sort of Fourier decomposition of the wave function, one can actually find an exact solution to this constraint. And it's given here. So this part is just like a regular holonomy. This part is a given function of K phi, and it's rather complicated, involves Jacobi elliptic function and so on, but it's a given function of phi. And finally in front, we have just like Kukash and Thiemann, psi of m, meaning that we can, the states are labeled by m, of course, which is a Dirac observable, and we can have superpositions for different values of the mass. Mind you, these states here are a solution of the Hamiltonian constraint. They're still not a solution of the diffeomorphism constraint. But that's easy to deal with because one has the traditional group averaging procedure, which in this case, in one dimension, what group averaging does for you is sort of this. If these are the vertices of the spin networks, you sort of sum over all possible motions of the vertices, and that will give you a state that is labeled by your graph and the set of integers k associated with all the radial directions. The integers mu associated with k phi are gone because this is a given function that is given once and for all. Something that we observe is that the model has quantum observables without classical counterparts. This is related to this fact. This is a basis of solutions for the Hamiltonian constraint for the physical states. And if you group averaging, this is a basis of states for all the constraints. And they're labeled by a set of integers k that don't change. That is, the number of vertices of our spin networks don't change upon evolution, if you want to put it that way. And these numbers don't change. So there's certainly invariant information associated with that. The number of vertices, the number of vertices in the spin network, one could associate an operator v with eigenvalue v, the number of vertices, and that's a Dirac observable, it doesn't change. So that, okay, you might say, fine, that's sort of interesting. But more interesting is that actually we can define a certain notion of invariance associated with Ex. Now, Ex, remember, if we go way back, Ex is g theta theta, is what normally we have as r squared. So in what sense could we say that that is invariant and that we could define it on the space of physical states? Well, again, it has to do with this thing I was doing with my fingers. You see, in three dimensions, a diffeomorphism can take a point here and a point here and do this and put them one in front of the other. There's no sense of ordering of the points. But in one dimension, diffeomorphisms can only do this. This point can never get past this point. And so, although there are diffeomorphisms, and therefore Ex itself is not going to be invariant, there is some notion of invariance to the fact that I cannot put points past one another without creating singularities. And so a portion of Ex has to have invariant character. Not all of it. It cannot be a Dirac observable, because it's not. But some portion of it is. And there is one way of doing this, and is to define a Dirac observable O parameterized by a parameter that goes between 0 and 1. And this O, acting on the space of physical states, what it does is it pulls out the successive values of K. So you have the sequences of all the Ks in your spin network, and you have this observable with Z swiping between 0 and 1. As it swipes between 0 and 1, it picks up all the values of K successively. That's K sub integer part of V times Z, where V is the number of vertices times Z. So this swipes between 0 to V, the total number of vertices, and as it does, it goes pulling down all the values of K along the spin network. Ex, in terms of that observable, is given by this, where this function Z of X is now an arbitrary function. So here's the sense in which this Ex is a Dirac observable. It is a Dirac observable because I write it in terms of this O that is a Dirac observable. But it's a Dirac observable parameterized by an arbitrary function that associated with the invariance under diffeomorphisms. That's what normally is considered an evolving constant of the motion. It is a constant of the motion, it's a Dirac observable, but it's parameterized normally by a parameter. In this case, the parameter is a function, and it's associated with a motion. What is the motion in this case? It's the diffeomorphism. Now that we have a sort of, so this Ex is an operator that is well defined on my physical state, space of states. Is just an evolving constant of the motion. It's parameterized by a function. In terms of this Ex, I can now proceed and put a hat on top of my metric, because I have everything well defined here, including Ex, and the resulting metric that I'm going to have is going to be an evolving constant of the motion as well. Why? Well, because the metric is not invariant under diffeomorphisms. As I swipe that function there, the metric is going to change. What kind of space-time emerges from this, you might say? Well, it depends on the state. You see, this is like a Schwarzschild black hole. It's sitting there forever and will never change, okay? Depending on what you choose as your initial data, that's what you're going to have. You could have a state that has a well-peaked value for the mass and therefore might correspond to a classical geometry in certain regions. Or you might choose a state that has a superposition of many masses and there's nothing classical anywhere. You could have a state that close to the singularity becomes non-singular but a lot of curvature, but you still have like a classical geometry there, or you could have a state that has a quantum region next to where the singularity is. That you can choose here. This model is just too simple to determine which of these is what happens in nature. It's just like a Schwarzschild black hole, it's sitting there forever. This is the kind of geometry that emerges, basically where the singularity was, you get a region of high curvature or a region that space-time is quantum, and so you could traverse it and go into an extra region up there. Let me finish with sort of some speculative comments. Everyone has heard this discussion of firewalls and black hole evaporation. We have these new observables in the bulk, so information could leak into there. And we also have that information could tunnel into the other region. So this could qualitatively change the picture for firewalls. Now, again, the solution is just too simple-minded to say anything about firewalls. There's no evaporation here. It's vacuum and so on. But it sort of sets the stage for potential calculations. The thing we're doing right now is using the techniques of Domagel and Lewandowski and Ivan mentioned this morning, putting a quantum field on this quantum geometry and seeing how it evaporates. That's what calculation we're doing right now. And that could have something more relevant to say with respect to this. Let me conclude here. So rescaling the Hamiltonian constraint leads to a Lie algebra, allows to do the Dirac quantization. Remarkably, it can be completed entirely in closed form. New quantum observables appear without classical counterparts. The metric can be realized in the space of physical states as an evolving constant of the motion. It is non-singular in the black hole interior, and the space-time can be extended. It may open new possibilities for the firewall problem. Thank you.
Very speculative one. You said you're going to try and do the computation for the firewall. Have you got any intuition of what's
going to
drop out?
No. I just said I was going to do something very basic and elementary, which is put a quantum field on this quantum geometry.
Yeah, yeah.
See how the quantum field evaporates.
Okay.
For instance, when it evaporates, is the interior and the exterior black hole entangled or not? That is something that people who believe in firewalls say they are not,
yeah.
And that one could see here if it's the case. Even if we see it's the case, they're not going to be convinced because they're going to say, well, this is just the field on a fixed background. Maybe when you put the back reaction, things change. But, you know, we'll progress in that direction.
Okay, great, thanks. More questions?
Is there any hope of going to non-spectrum-symmetric geometries, even if they're only interpretively so?
The way I see it right now is spherically symmetric is so rich a system. There's so much to be learned here that I'm not too concerned about that right now. Spherically symmetric gravity with matter, with scalar field, has the Chopwick phenomena, has black hole evaporations. Yes, it's evaporation in the S mode. Okay, it's not the full thing. But you have the information paradox. You have everything there. So if we could handle that, that would be great. So I'm not terribly concerned at the moment with non-spherical symmetry.
Yeah. I saw there's massa in your function. Is it a continuous variable? Does it happen to be a quantized?
It's a term anyway. Mm-hmm. Very. Yeah. It's a direct observable.
Okay. Thank you.
This is good, you think?
Our next speaker is Matteo Smetlak, and he will tell us about polyimide complex color.
Yeah, thank you, Eugenio. I want to apologize to the experts in the room, probably they are, because I'm not, and I may misrepresent the literature. And so if I do, I'm happy to hear it, and in any case, I apologize for it. Here is, for a start, my very brief history of Hawking radiation, the way I see it. Two steps. The first is, of course, Hawking's 1974 discovery of black hole evaporation, where he found that black holes act as black body. More precisely, he wrote, any black hole will create and emit particles at just the rate that one would expect if the black hole was a body with a temperature of kappa over 2 pi, with kappa being the surface gravity of the hole. 2 years later, Unruh clarified the situation quite a bit, in particular by studying the response of infalling detectors, and concluded that a geodesic detector near the horizon will not see the Hawking flux of particles, and this is one statement that I want to reconsider in this talk. And there's a long history, many, many papers along the way. One recent one that has attracted attention is the so-called firewall argument, where the authors concluded that perhaps the most conservative resolution is that the infalling observer burns up at the horizon, which is rather different from this scenario here. And so what I want to do in this talk is to reconsider the semi-classics, unlike the firewall crowd, a la Hawking and Unruh, old style, but with a twist, which is to study non-asymptotic, non-stationary trajectories. In particular, I'll consider geodesics with orbital parameters in a Schwarzschild spacetime with orbital parameters E and L, E being the energy per unit rest mass, and L, the angular momentum per unit rest mass. And so I'll show that, so three things. I believe one is that geodesic detectors near the horizon, they do see Hawking radiation, and actually they do so more than at infinity. In the limit of zero killing energy limit, I'll show that horizon radiation is both hot and intense. And I'll have a final section on the fact that the vacuum energy density does not have a definite sign about the horizon. So I'll start with just some review on collapse geometry and the structure of the in vacuum. And this is my setup. It's the most simplistic setup I could think of, where in a spacetime that starts off as Minkowski, as flat at past infinity, a null shell collapses and forms a black hole that's stationary and even static. So there's two regions in this space-time. One is the inside region, which is just flat, and one is the outside region, and that's Schwarzschild. In other words, I'm considering spherically symmetric space-time with no charge, and that's flat in the past. As for the field, I'll consider a massless scalar field, and furthermore, I'll restrict to the spherically symmetric sector of the field, meaning I'll truncate anything that's not an S wave for the field. Now, this might sound like a drastic approximation, for to the best of my understanding, it's been checked numerically, in particular by Page, that indeed S waves constitute most of Hawking radiation. They dominate Hawking radiation, and so it's not a crazy approximation, I think. And the way I'll probe Hawking radiation is by the old trick of Unruh of considering a point-like monopole detector that's weakly coupled to the field. So I'm considering an Unruh de Witt detector. Just a few more details about this collapse geometry that I'll need. If I write the geometry here in Eddington-Filgenstein coordinate, it'll look like this, where RS is the Schwarzschild radius, that's twice the mass of the black hole. Theta is the Heaviside function, and it defines two regions, one for V negative, which is inside the shell, and that's flat, and one for V positive, and that's outside the shell, that's Schwarzschild. And I'll consider a set of double null coordinates that I call V plus and V minus, which make the radial time radial part of the metric conformal to flat. And the interpretation, so the way I construct these two coordinates is as follows. I take a point x and trace back the two null rays that meet at x. One will arrive on past null infinity here and the other there. And since I have the v coordinate, the v Eddington-Filgenstein coordinate on scry minus, I can just take v plus of x and v minus of x as a pair of coordinates for x. That's a well-defined, globally defined coordinate system for collapse geometry, and that is null, and so the metric is conformal to flat. The interpretation of these coordinates is as follows in terms of the iconal approximation for a massless field. Constant v plus surfaces like this correspond to incoming fronts, so they're really like this, rather. And constant V minus surfaces, which are like this, correspond to outgoing wave fronts. V plus, as I said, equals zero is the shell itself, right here. V minus equals minus twice the Schwarzschild radius is the horizon. All I need to know about the vacuum state is its two-point function, again, because I'm just considering the Unruh de Witt detector. And in these coordinates, it takes this simple form where delta V plus and delta V minus are the difference for the V plus and V minus coordinates between x and y, the two points for the Whiteman function. The structure of outgoing fronts is interesting. So that's the V minus coordinates. It's interesting because it has this very drastic change, which I'll explain just now. If I set delta to be the relative distance to the horizon, so delta is positive outside the horizon and negative inside, V minus of V and R as a function of Eddington-Filgenstein coordinates takes this form. One is simple, and that's outside the shell. This is really just the flat space-time bouncing off relationship for a ray that bounces off the center and gets back. And this is a slightly more complicated expression for the region outside the shell. And you see that, well, the mass of the shell is in there. And there's also this function here of R via delta and V. And W here is the Lambert W function that I plotted here for convenience. The thing to notice is that it has a linear approximation at the origin. For small values of the arguments, W of Z goes like Z. And so what's interesting here is this particular combination of R and V that has this drastically changing behavior for negative delta and positive delta. For negative delta, this combination here is almost flat and zero. And for a positive delta, it shoots off super fast. And so this transition between flat and super fast growth is what generates the Hawking phenomenon. One way of seeing it is by plotting the constant V minus surfaces in VR coordinates. So V equals zero is the shell, and it's here. So below this line here, this dotted line, is the region inside the shell. And so here you see the phase fronts of a massless field. But just after the shell, you see that it takes a dramatically different shape. Here, R equals 2m is the horizon. And you see that it separates. It's just about the horizon, there's this strong separation of the outgoing wave fronts. And so there's this region here, which is in this super fast growth domain, where the Hawking phenomenon is taking place. So this is what I call the Hawking region. Outside of it is just like flat space time. There's no Hawking effect. Inside of it, there's the Hawking effect. You see that it expands away from the horizon until it completely covers the whole of space time, and eventually Hawking radiation is detected at infinity. So this is the onset. This is a picture, if you wish, of the onset of Hawking radiation, and you can think of it as a portrait of the vacuum and the way it's broken open somehow by the collapse phenomenon and the formation of the horizon. Okay, now I want to tell you about the vacuum temperature recorded by Unruh-de-Witt detectors along geodesics in this space-time. So I recall that the response of an Unruh-de-Witt detector at time tau reads this expression here, where there's several ingredients. One is gamma, and that's the word line of the detector. G, again, is the two-point function for the field, and so what I have here is the two-point function evaluated along two points on the word line. Omega is the energy gap for the Unruh-de-Witt detector, so it's a frequency. S is proper time along the geodesic, and you see that there's a switching function chi here, which is not often written, but it's important for regularity of these rates, especially in the ultraviolet limit. So it's defined as a unit integral function that's positive in general, and that becomes zero for S larger than tau. So observe that the Whiteman function in my effectively 1 plus 1 dimensional approximation splits in two terms. And so because the Whiteman function shows up linearly in the detector rates, you see that the detector rates really have two contributions. One comes from the ingoing modes, and the other from the outgoing modes, okay, the V plus and V minus vacuum fluctuations. And so in this limit, like I said, they do decouple. Okay, I'll call a stationary spectrum thermal, one that does not depend on observation time tau, thermal, if the detailed balance relation holds, which is this quantity here, this relationship, for any value of the detector frequency omega. But because I'm considering non-stationary geodesics as well, I want to give a meaning to the notion of thermality or quasi-thermality for non-stationary spectra. And so what I'll do is I'll just consider the ultraviolet tail of the spectrum and call a spectrum that's non-stationary still quasi-thermal if the detailed balance relation holds asymptotically for large frequencies in the ultraviolet. In this case, I call the T here entering this asymptotic detailed balance relationship a quasi-temperature. And of course, it does become a proper temperature in the adiabatic limit when it changes sufficiently slow. It's easy enough in that setup to give a sufficient condition for thermality of the rates in terms of the V plus and V minus coordinates evaluated along the geodesic, along the world line of the detector. So if you recall that this Fourier transform here is really zero when the argument is just linear in S, you can understand that the first relevant term in the actual two-point function is the second order derivative of this quantity, which is delta V plus or minus, with respect to S. And so in fact, it's easy to show that when the quantity defined as follows, 1 over 2 pi, and the second derivative of V plus or V minus over the first derivative with respect to proper time of V plus or V minus is a constant, then integrating this relationship, you get an exponential relationship between these iconal null coordinates and proper time along the geodesic, in which case you'll get a thermal spectrum at temperature precisely T plus or T minus. Okay? So this is precisely what happens with static trajectories, the ones that are well known. If I consider a static trajectory outside the hole where delta, the relative distance to the horizon, is a constant, a positive constant, then it's simple algebra to see that this ratio here is really kappa over this factor here, which gives, if you look at it, precisely T minus equals kappa over 2 pi multiplied by the Tolman factor, the usual Tolman factor for a static detector at a finite distance. So that's for outgoing modes. Outgoing modes are thermal at the Hawking temperature weighted by the Tolman factor. And so it just follows immediately from this approach. And you also find that for a static trajectory, the quasi-temperature of ingoing modes is just zero. They do not couple. They are not thermal in this collapse vacuum. Okay, so like I said, for a more general non-static trajectory, the quantities here are only the quasi-temperatures of incoming and outgoing modes, and the corresponding adiabaticity parameters are given by this. And it's only when eta plus or minus is much smaller than 1 than these quantities, these quasi-temperatures, are really are temperatures in the usual sense. So the advantages of this approach to Hawking radiation that I just sketched for you is that, one, it's easy to compute. You just need to evaluate two derivatives of a simply defined coordinate on space-time along a geodesic, along a trajectory, in fact, whatever trajectory you like. Just evaluate this, and you get the values of the quasi-temperatures, and then check by computing these adiabaticity parameters whether they're small, in which case the quasi-temperatures really are unreduced temperatures. Furthermore, the interpretation of these quantities in the non-static case is rather straightforward. It just controls the ultraviolet decay rate of the detector spectra, meaning how the detector spectra behave for large omegas at large frequencies. Okay, so one kind of geodesics you can consider applying this formalism to is circular orbits around a black hole. Okay, I just told you about static orbits. It's easy enough to consider circular orbits, and so what you find is this expression here, where you recall that delta is the relative distance to the horizon. It's a positive number. And you find that if you plot this quantity here as a function of delta for circular orbits, you get the black line here. And you can compare that to the temperature of a static detector at the same distance to the hole, and that's the dashed line here. And so you find that the temperature of outgoing modes along circular orbits is higher than that of static detectors at the same distance from the hole. Of course, in this circular case, for a stationary trajectory like that, you also find that ingoing modes do not couple. You could also compute this quantity numerically along more general Schwarzschild geodesics. You could consider ones that have both finite energy and finite angular momentum. So the trajectory might look like this, where the red circle is the horizon. Yep. And so what you find is two things. You find that as the detector approaches the black hole, at some point it enters the Hawking region, so the outgoing quasi-temperature becomes finite now. So this is the entering the Hawking region. This is the Hawking effect. And as the horizon is approached, you see that it goes up and takes 4 times the value that it had away from the black hole. Now, what's interesting is also that the quasi-temperature of ingoing modes, which is, as I said, 0 in most stationary cases, now becomes non-zero when you approach the horizon. So in other words, ingoing modes, they do couple near the horizon. So you can apply this to radial trajectories now, which are observers falling into the black hole. And so you'll find that at horizon crossing, for instance, the quasi-temperature of outgoing modes is 4 times E, the energy, times the Hawking temperature. And interestingly, the quasi-temperature of ingoing modes now is not 0. Instead, it's given by this formula here. And so it becomes large in the limit of small E, which corresponds to highly bound observers close to the black hole. In particular, it sort of shoots off for a very small E. So what you find is, therefore, large quasi-temperature for ingoing modes for highly bound states. Of course, the spectrum is never actually thermal because the adiabaticity parameters are not zero. It's interesting to compare this computation of temperatures and quasi-temperatures with local in-time observables like flux and energy density. And so that's what I did. I considered the outgoing flux received by an infalling observer, which is given by the vacuum expectation value of the energy momentum tensor contracted with the four velocity of the observer and some unit normal to it, NB. And so what I found is, at horizon crossing in particular, the outgoing flux not only is not zero, but can become very large, in fact, in the E going to zero limit, which I recall again, is for highly bound observers. So these particular observers that you can think of as just dropped just above the horizon with zero initial velocity will record a large outgoing flux of Hawking radiation. You can also consider the energy density in the vacuum as measured by these observers. So again, you get it by contracting the energy momentum tensor with the four velocity of the observers. And what you find is interesting, what you find is it does not have a definite sign outside the hole. It's usually said that outside the black hole, The vacuum energy density is negative. There's a negative energy atmosphere around the black hole. Well, this is only really for one type of observer, and boosting does not preserve this quantity. Changing the velocity does not preserve this quantity. So here I plotted the vacuum energy density as a function of the Killing energy of geodesic observers in this space-time. At horizon crossing, for instance, it has this shape here. And so you see that for large energies, it's positive. It vanishes for some critical energy and then becomes highly negative, in fact, even at the horizon in the E going to zero limit. For comparison, I've showed the vacuum energy density at infinity for the same observers, the same energy, and you find that it's anyway larger. It's always larger than at infinity. So in some sense, the Hawking phenomenon is not weaker at the horizon, it's larger in this sense. Another thing you can consider is how rho depends on the radius in Schwarzschild coordinates along a geodesic, and you find that it has very different behaviors depending on the value of the Killing energy. So E equals 1 corresponds to observers that are dropped from infinity with zero initial velocity. And so this is the pink line here. It starts off small, then has a maximum, becomes negative, and tends to minus infinity. But you see that for observers that have some initial velocity directed towards the hole, the shape is, if qualitatively the same, quantitatively rather different. And for highly bound observers, again, you find that it's always negative. Okay, and so it does not have this positive maximum at some distance away from the hole.
So here is in Leblanc?
Pardon me?
In Leblanc, the dimensions
of E. Oh, it's just a number, really.
Yes, I mean, this is in terms of Leblanc, so when you say E equal to 1.
There's nothing Planck about this. This is a classical thing. For a geodesic in the classical Schwarzschild spacetime, some quantity is conserved along geodesics, that's the Killing energy, because the outside Killing region is static, and so that's the conserved quantity. And so it's normalized so that it's 1 for those observers that are dropped from infinity towards the hole with zero initial velocity. And so the punchlines here, and I'm finishing my talk at that point, is that for highly bound trajectories, Hawking radiation is actually dominated by ingoing modes as opposed to outgoing modes. And it becomes arbitrarily hot in the sense that I explained in the talk, as you consider geodesic observers that are highly bound to the black hole. And so in this E going to zero limit, I've showed that the outgoing flux goes to positive infinity, but the energy density in the vacuum goes to negative infinity. So this is really a singular limit, because E strictly equals to zero would not be a time-like observer, that would be a null observer, and so this limiting value is never actually attained. Another punchline is that not all observers actually do measure this negative energy density. This negative energy density close to the horizon. I've shown that observers that are actually rushing into the hole at high velocity would see a high positive energy density there. And also, I want to conclude by stressing again that this is a purely semi-classical effect. It has no conceptual connection whatsoever with a firewall argument or anything of the sort. And so I would like to thank you for listening to me here.
So do you have a simple physical argument why the observables who are orbiting actually see a measure higher temperature than the static ones?
Well, I mean, there's several effects which could change the temperature that's perceived by a given observer. One is gravitational redshift. That's the Tolman factor that we know very well for static observers. And another one is the Doppler effect, right, if you're just moving. So those observers that are in static orbits around the black hole, when they go close to the black hole, they're orbiting really fast. And so it's not easy to me to know whether a priori the Doppler effect on circular orbits will be larger than the gravitational redshift effect at the same distance. In fact, it's just a stronger number. It's a high number. And so the temperatures Doppler shifted along these circular orbits is higher than the temperature gravitationally redshifted at a finite fixed position away from the black hole.
More questions? But I have one more.
Sure.
When you write the flux, this is written in terms of in your new contact with U, A, and B, U, mu, and mu.
Yes.
What are these properties? Are properties of U, and then what are properties of T?
So the properties of T that are relevant is that it does not satisfy the positive energy condition. So this is an energy momentum tensor that's not positive in the usual classical GR sense, and so there's no reason to expect that the energy density should have a definite sign or it should be positive. In fact, it does not. Now, the actual value that you get, and in fact also the sign that you get, turns out to, no, not in the flux case. The value that you get turns out to depend on who measures it, and that's a usual situation in general relativity when there's a non-zero energy momentum tensor somewhere and you start moving relative to the proper frame of that tensor, you find different values. And so that's what I'm seeing here. So, but my point was really to stress that even close to the horizon or at the horizon, there's no reason to conclude, I think, with UNRU that the Hawking flux of particles is not seen there. In fact, it's seen there usually at a higher temperature and for a higher value of energy density and flux than at infinity. And in particular, the null limit where E goes to zero, meaning that the observer is trying to stay almost static at the horizon, that becomes very large, actually.
Second question.
All right, so you mentioned actually that this has nothing to do with the firewall argument at all.
Yeah.
Because it is semi-classical argument.
Yeah.
However, I thought that if you are near the horizon and if the black hole is very, very big, I mean, semi-classical analysis is good enough.
I think it's good enough, yeah?
Yeah, so then why do you say that this has nothing to do with the conceptual framework for firewall?
Because it has nothing to do with it. Nothing. Neither the assumption, I don't assume unitarity is preserved, I don't do anything of the sort. I'm not following the same track. I arrive at a different, at a result that's different, and that does not correlate in any way with the result, as far as I can tell. Yeah.
Okay.
Thank you.
Yes. Thank you, Matteo.
Thank you for your introduction. Today I will talk about a relation between fluid dynamics and gravity. This work is motivated by Lorentz's talk. My talk is a more local viewpoint. Okay, let's start. Our key question is gravity thermodynamics? Of course, gravity is described by curved space-time. And space-time itself, dynamic object by general relativity. On the other hand, thermodynamics is, from macroscopic viewpoint, characterized by first law, second law, temperature, entropy, and so on. So, if you introduce dynamical effect into thermodynamics, that is, if you consider non-equilibrium phenomena, then it becomes fluid dynamics. So this is the question. So in other words, is space-time a fluid? So if you consider from macroscopic viewpoint this problem, then the question is, does space-time follow fluid dynamics? That is, the Navier-Stokes equation, today's topic is this. And of course, we have to consider second law for space-time. And of course, you can consider this problem from microscopic viewpoint. Then the question is, do space-time agents constitute space-time? This is the question. So if you want to attack this problem, then you need a model of quantum gravity and covariant formalism of statistical mechanics. I'm interested in this problem in future. But today, I will talk about macroscopic viewpoint. So let's go back this question again. Space-time, of course, described by general relativity. General relativity has key property, that is, Diffeomfelsen invariance. On the other hand, fluid follows fluid dynamics and features based on preferred time t and some laboratory frame. So they are so different. So our key question is, how can we understand this gap? So here, let's recall fluid dynamics a little. Basically, fluid dynamics is governed, these three equations. One is mass conservation, and the second one is momentum conservation, so Navier-Stokes equation. And the final one is first law. And of course, you have to use thermodynamical relation. And another key point is, in fluid dynamics, there are two kinds of observers. One is moving observer who follows fluid particles and measure purely thermodynamic quantity, so temperature, entropy, so on. And another guy is a laboratory observer. He is at rest with respect to the laboratory and measure velocity. So this is the picture. So, okay, how about general relativity? I think fluid velocity is given by a time-like vector. And if so, a two-dimensional spatial fluid system is given by a time-like surface, like this. If this setup is correct, then choice of laboratory and time corresponds to choice of foliation and frame on the screen. And after this, a laboratory observer, of course, automatically given by this time-like normal vector n, like this. In this talk, I will call time-like surface by screen. So, the key question is reduced to, can we choose a time-like vector foliation and frame on the screen such that vector follows the Navier-Stokes equation? This is a complete question. So let's start construction of fluid dynamics of space-time. This is set up. First, metric is given. And after that, some time-like surface also given, which is characterized by a space-like unit vector f, like this. And then you have induced metric h mu nu on the surface. And next, consider some time-like foliation t, like this. Then you have normal time-like unit vector and also. So you obtain the metric of a two-dimensional space like laboratory S here is given by like this. And in this setup, you can construct a surface energy momentum tensor on the screen. So using Israel junction condition for the screen or is in black hole membrane paradigm, then you can obtain this tensor, which is actually the same as Brown-Yorke tensor, right? And furthermore, you will decompose the tensor like this. So then this epsilon is energy density, and pi mu is momentum density, and large pi mu nu is stress tensor, right? And here n is a laboratory observer, so these quantities for laboratory observer. Okay, furthermore, you can use this tensor to make conservation laws for the screen like this. This conservation law. This means some energy comes into the screen and then it spread out on the screen, right? So for example, if you estimate this component equation, that is spatial component, then this become this form. This is a Lie derivative of momenta, and theta t is given by this, and gradient p, gradient theta, and this term, and matter energy momentum density. And look this term. This term is actually Newton gravity force. Because phi is given by like this, and rho is actually lambda shift factor in the four-dimensional spacetime. So in this setup, Newton gravity automatically emerges. And next, interestingly, this same equation can also be derived directly from Einstein equation. So if you decompose the Einstein equation by this metric form, then, for example, this component actually become the same equation. So in this sense, this equation are the dynamic equation of motion for the screen. Here, let's compare this with fluid equation. This is Navier-Stokes equation, but I wrote in another form here. Here, dt is Lagrange derivative. Important is this convective term. And theta is complexity, of course, include velocity. And the momentum also given by mass density times velocity. So pressure, viscous tensor, and Newton force, and other external force, okay? So you see, these are so similar, but problem is here, from fluid velocity Va does not appear in this equation. And P theta epsilon are not measured by moving observer. So in this sense, this equation is not Navier-Stokes equation yet. Note here, other component is also similar to first law. So this situation is similar in other equations. So question, how can we identify the physical velocity of the screen fluid? Here, we can refer to relativistic fluid dynamics. In relativistic fluid dynamics, velocity is determined by this condition, usually. Here, this equation means velocity is proportional to energy flow. So actually, this condition define U vector, time-like U vector on the screen, such that the spatial component V is given by like this for given foliation. Here I use a 1 plus 2 formalism in the screen. So this equation means this fluid velocity is moving at velocity v with respect to the laboratory observer n. So in this sense, this represents physical velocity. And actually, this condition, that is, this u and v relate quantities for the moving observers and ones for laboratory observers like this. So epsilon quantity, epsilon is for commoving observer, which is defined like this. So this relation is actually same as usual relativistic fluid ones. So in this sense, the screen can be considered as relativistic fluid. But we still do not have exact Navier-Stokes equation. So how can we obtain the exact Navier-Stokes equation from here? Hint is there. First, we still can use diffeomorphism for two-dimensional spatial space S and one for linear direction S in four-dimensional spacetime. And furthermore, we have to consider constituent equation which relate viscose tensor and deformation tensor to satisfy second law. And furthermore, I think this condition correspond to physical laboratory, because in real world, the metric of the spatial system, of course, constant. So now we are trying to this problem. So this is conclusion. For arbitrary time-like screen, we made hydrodynamic-like equations from the Einstein equation by using 2 plus 2 decomposition formalism, or using conservation laws for screen. And by identifying the physical velocity, then we constructed energy momentum tensor, which takes relativistic fluid dynamic form. So these results strongly suggest spacetime itself behavior is fluid. Thank you very much.
Space-time itself behaves as a fluid.
Yeah.
Can you explain this to me? Because it seems to me that what behaves as a fluid is the screen, which has a, which is distributed in space-time. It has nothing to do with space-time, really. It's an extra structure.
Mm-hmm.
And so why would you say that space-time itself behaves as a fluid when it's really a physical boundary in space-time that behaves as a fluid?
Okay. So this setup can be used any time-like screen. So So here is also here, here, so anywhere is okay. So so if you want to use a physical boundary, so this is this formalism also apply to. And of course, you can consider always arbitrary region, so in this sense.
Okay,
so if you're saying So if you're saying Einstein equations are in some sense equivalent with Navier-Stokes equations, or you're trying to get that. So could you comment on the fact that there's still the open and unsolved issue of existence and uniqueness of Navier-Stokes solutions to Navier-Stokes equation, in the sense that if really Einstein equations are equivalent to Navier-Stokes equations, then you solve the problem of existence and uniqueness of solutions to the Navier-Stokes equations by knowing the solutions in Einstein equations.
Sorry, what is your question?
So,
another question is at all, how are you going to get $1 million? Just do that.
So basically, if you manage to prove that Einstein equations are Navier-Stokes equations, then you just have to go to one place and get $1 million.
Maybe you should do that. Another question.
Thank you.
I don't understand why you want this equation, the Navier-Stokes form.
I mean, the fluid dynamics is just basically a low energy effective field theory of the last Laws-like modes defined by certain conserved quantities.
Okay.
You have the conserved quantities. Okay, it doesn't have to be the Navier-Stokes form. I mean, it could be a different type of fluid. Generically, fluid dynamics just effective field theory defined in terms of, you know, conserved quantities. There's certain conserved quantities, certain conservation laws, and that's it. You don't have to write it in Navier-Stokes form.
I mean, Navier-Stokes equation in large sense, Navier-Stokes equation mean just a momentum conservation law for a continuum medium, right? So in principle, this equation can include elastic object, right? So depending on constituent equation, this equation can become exact form of Navier-Stokes equation. But if you use other form of constituent equation, this equation take another form. So in this sense, I'm interested in general meaning of space-time.
Okay. Okay. Let's thank you.
Thank you, Jimmy. Thanks for the introduction. Also, I'll thank organizers for giving me this opportunity to speak of my work. This talk will be largely based upon the work reported on in these papers done with my collaborators and Alo. So, here is the plan. It's short. So, I will first try to give a brief introduction of recent proposal of treating the punctures, the topological defects on isolated horizons as quantum here. We will do statistical analysis with these new degrees of freedom introduced. We will see what kind of correction to the standard Einstein, the standard Bekenstein-Hawking area law is obtained when this quantum here is taken into the picture. And then I will discuss the implication of the corrections. So we know how is a black hole is treated in loop quantum gravity. This black hole space-time is taken as space-time with an inner boundary. Having inner boundary, we have a Chern-Simons theory on the boundary. So the isolated horizon is a surface which has a Chern-Simons theory on it. And the spin network edges in the bulb pierce the isolated horizon, giving the topological defects. And this topological defects construct the microstates accounting for the entropy of the isolated horizon. So in this case, area of the horizon is an observable. So we try to do statistical analysis for this observable and try to get up with corresponding thermodynamic quantities. So microcanonical studies have been done by various set of groups with different schemes implied. Basically, the idea is to get the number of configurations which respect two conditions. One, the area of the horizon is given by this quantity. P denotes a particular puncture which comes up with a spin network label J, which is irreducible representation of a SU2 group. So it contributes this much amount of area up to this factor. And we sum over all the punctures to give rise to the total area of the isolated horizon. The second is the spin projection on some particular axis that should sum up to zero so that the horizon has a spherical topology. And then we can count the number of such configurations making up the isolated horizon. And that gives me the entropy. Taking the log of the number of configurations will give me the entropy.
So what we get in microcanonical studies, the counting entropy is at the leading order proportional to A. So it's a strong hint that Bekenstein-Hawking area relation would be obtained. That is done by fixing this parameter coming in front to particular appropriate value. And then at the subleading level, we have a logarithmic correction with a negative signature. So this is the scheme usually done in microcanonical school. Here, the number of punctures is not taken as a particular the statistical variable, because the number of punctures are actually the flux lines, and that cannot be actually held fixed in a given set of configurations. So this is a kind of reminiscent of entropy calculation of a photon gas, where we really don't constrain the number of photons in the system. But there have been proposals that given the number of punctures, some Dirac observables, we can actually treat them as quantum hairs. So this was suggested as early as that, and very recently this has been put into use for describing a black hole with a quantum hair. So for doing so, we associate a chemical potential associated puncture, that is the cost of putting a puncture into the horizon, and then horizon is to be treated as a gas of punctures. So the outcome of this is that we have a modified version of the first law, where from the standard thing which is tedious here, we have a contribution from the number of punctures as well with a chemical potential sitting in. We do statistical analysis and we see that leading order again, at the leading order of entropy, we again get the Bekenstein-Hawking area relation, and there is a correction term which is universal in sense that comes with the number of punctures and corresponding function of chemical potential. Our scheme is to do the statistical analysis for this and see what are the implications for the subleading corrections for this kind of entropy. For this, we will do in two steps. For the first step, we will first fix the number of punctures on an isolated horizon, a graph, and then calculate the corresponding canonical partition function. In the first step, we calculate the partition function for a given graph with a number of punctures given as n. So this is given by this expression, where total number of punctures is sum over all punctures carrying spin level j and projection level nj. And this is a particular delta function which ensures that sum of projections is 0, so that the spherical topology is maintained. So with a suitable representation of this delta function, the partition function can be turned into this. And using the binomial theorem, it's simply this. So for convenience, if we will like to work with a equidistant spectrum, but one can always do the exact partition, exact area spectrum with a Millin-Brenz transformation for perturbative corrections towards lower J values. For high J values, this approximation will be good enough. So in that case, the partition function becomes somewhat more tractable, and we hope that it will be evaluated as good as possible in the thermodynamic limit where number of punctures is very large. So for that, we do a transformation to bring it to some kind of more familiar form. By looking at this function, the distribution function over in the integral has two properties. One is this, it is symmetric in X. Secondly, it is unimodal. If we plot it, then we have a plot like this, which is a unimodal symmetric distribution. So we'll like to approximate it as accurately as we can. So for that, seeing a unimodal and symmetric distribution, our first guess would be to try a Gaussian on it. How do we do that? For doing that, we first see that for a Gaussian with a zero mean, moment generating function is given by this expression. And actually, we can play around and cast the moment generating function into some constant times the probability distribution function itself. And now, if we have to calculate the nth moment of the distribution, it is given by this expression, can, by using the fact that moment generating function itself is related to the probability distribution function, can be casted into the derivatives of the probability distribution function at the center and the value of the probability distribution function at the center itself. So for example, the variance will be given by the second derivative and the distribution function itself at the center. Similarly, the fourth moment is given by the fourth derivative and the value of the distribution function at the center itself. So we can calculate, we know the variance from the previous formula, and we can calculate the kurtosis of this distribution, which is the amount of pickedness of the distribution, and that is given by combination of second derivative squared, fourth derivative, and the distribution function value itself at the center. So the kurtosis for our expression, our probability distribution function, what we have got for the partition function, turns out like this. This is not very good looking in itself, but we can evaluate it in thermodynamic limit. So for thermodynamic limit, we see that something called excess kurtosis, which is the departure from the distribution of from being a Gaussian, actually vanishes. For Gaussian, the kurtosis is 3. The excess kurtosis measures the departure from being a Gaussian. So for our distribution in the n tending to infinity limit, thermodynamic limit, the departure vanishes, and this actually can be well approximated by a Gaussian, and we can evaluate the area of a Gaussian very easily. So the partition function becomes this. So the corresponding, we can calculate the canonical entropy corresponding to that, this partition function, and we extremize the entropy with the number of, with respect to the number of constituents. So this is again a reminder of photon gas, where we take del S upon del N with all other parameters fixed so that mu is 0. So it's kind of photon gas calculation. So again at the canonical level, we get something at the leading order proportional to area and subleading correction, which is negative in signature. So we can fix the coefficient A over here and get the Bekenstein-Hawking relation, and we will get the corresponding Imerizev parameter, and there are, we can compare with other studies, so it's not a big deal. So point is, we at the canonical level itself, at the microcanonical level we have a negative correction, and the canonical level as well we have a negative signature of the correction, logarithmic correction. So next, we want to allow the number of punctures to vary. So for canonical ensemble, we had to fix the one graph. For doing so, we will calculate the corresponding grand canonical partition function that is evaluated. That can be evaluated from knowing the canonical partition function and the corresponding averaged quantities over that, average number of punctures, average area of the horizon can be obtained through this formula, where we have put an efficacy or the cost of putting a particular puncture in by appearing as a lambda. So we know the canonical partition function. We can evaluate the grand canonical partition function again with the approximation scheme. So it's well approximated by a Gaussian, that is. So we do a saddle point approximation and get the grand canonical partition function like this, with suitable functions, z and beta. So we see that large n limit in this case is given by particular lambda fugacity and z appearing over here as tending to 1. In this limit, one can show that average area over average number depends on the chemical potential itself and is constant for isothermal cases. So chemical potential case itself can be related to the temperature. It has been also shown in previous work by Ghosh and Perez. So it turns out to be a good intensive variable to use for defining a thermodynamic limit. So we do a Legendre transformation of this partition function and obtain the entropy. So entropy is given by this expression then. So at some fixed value of the temperature or of the chemical potential, since both of them are related by some expression like this, we obtain the average number is directly related to average area. And then we can put it back. And then there is a corresponding correction factor of log n appearing due to fluctuation in number of n. So at the overall level, there is a corresponding signature change of logarithmic correction coming on from the fluctuation of number n. For isothermal cases, we know that this term will be constant, and we will get the Bekenstein-Hawking relation again up to fixing the Imerizev parameter. But now the logarithmic correction has become positive signature and differs from the microcanonical results or canonical what we have seen. And this picture holds true even for photon gas scenario, where the fact that we have put in we have allowed the fluctuation in n, there is a corresponding log n correction coming in, and at the isothermal cases, this changes the signature of the logarithmic corrections. So this is something not expected for a system which has large in the thermodynamic limit, or in symbol dependent result should not be there. But we are seeing at the sub-leading order there is some difference. So difference of in symbols is related to probably taking thermodynamic limit correctly. Although we have seen that A over N was a good nice quantity to use and tending to infinity, A over N was a good intensive variable, but it looks like even then we are getting something in symbol dependent results. For zero chemical potential, again, we will recover the same immunity parameter what we have there. But in general, the immunity parameter will be a chemical potential dependent quantity. So some discussions about this. So we see that the area relation can be achieved for isothermal cases. In general, this immunity parameter is a function of chemical potential or the temperature. The canonical or grand canonical analysis suggests correction to area law, but comes up with opposite signatures. And that differs from microcanonical analysis that was also reported in earlier work by Barbero et al, but for zero chemical potential. And now we have seen this chemical potential independent statement. So signature of the subleading term is actually crucial for studying the stability. So in this area and symbol picture, if the it's the subleading term signature, which will decide the concavity or convexivity of the entropy function, and hence the stability of the corresponding black hole in that ensemble. And recently there has been proposal to turn the area ensemble into energy ensemble also in terms of local observers. And then the stability we will be talking about will be actually the thermal stability. Then so taking the number of punctures as quantum here we have shown that has implication for stability, and probably we can make a statement vice versa as well, that depending upon stability requirements, what we should put as a quantum here or not should be decided by this factor or the correction terms. Okay, so that's all. Thank you.
Isothermal case. What do you mean by isothermal?
Okay. So, suppose we go for energy ensemble case. We make a area ensemble energy ensemble correspondence with terms of local observers. So then it has been shown that for those local observers, there exists a universal temperature for given proper distance away from horizon. There is a universal temperature for those observers. Then the process is isothermal. These are a particular temperature. And then we have a Hawking area, the Bekenstein Hawking relation.
Okay. Other questions? Yes.
In the second line, this parameter is a function of the temperature chemical potential. So can you interpret the parameter as one thermodynamic quantity?
Actually, it's a conjugate variable. It's a function of the conjugate variable to a particular thermodynamic quantity. So it itself is not a observable in the theory, but it turns out to be a function of the conjugate variables, just like temperature and chemical potential, which are conjugate to area and the number of punctures.
So what corresponds to real in real world? What does the parameter corresponds to
what kind of thermodynamic quantity does
the parameter correspond?
Okay, so the immunity parameter you are asking.
Yes.
So the immunity parameter actually, in loop quantum gravity scheme, the value of the immunity parameter will decide about the spacing of area elements.
I know.
So it will decide how spacious they are. Uh-huh. Secondly, there are also schemes of relating this immunity parameter to something called ringing mode of the black holes. So if you perturb the black holes, and see its perturbation far away and it should be oscillatory in nature. So particular value of gamma, the immediacy parameter, will correspond to the correct separation between the corresponding energy eigenstates of the black hole.
Thank you. Okay, let's thank the speaker again. Thank you for attending, and there's a conference for all.